time go?
I think you mean go time, pal.
Is it time go?
Time go. It's time go. Amaze. Time go.
All right. Yes, everybody. Jazz hands.
Two thumbs down.
Perfect for radio.
Yes.
All right. Well, welcome back, everybody, to Take Me to Your Reader, discussing adapted science fiction at its best and worst. I'm Seth.
I'm James.
And I'm Colin.
And welcome to everybody who came over directly after listening to the Hugo's There episode that I did with Peter Kusky about this book, because I'm going to put something in the episode to direct people over here in case they want to listen to us talk about the movie. And so, of course, we have Peter with us. Hi, Peter.
Hello. How's it going?
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Yes. So we have all seen Project Hail Mary. We have all read it just the one time. Definitely just the one time.
What is this one time thing you mentioned?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about all that. And we're going to go full spoilers, so if you have not seen the movie yet, tough.
Go do that.
Yeah.
Also, I just want to say, how was that your most watched episode from last year?
Most listened to?
Yes.
That what one. Was?
The one he did with me on Project Hail Mary.
Yeah, I mean, there was literally a comment.
Apparently.
Yeah, there was a comment on it that said, I came right over from the trailer. So.
Oh, dang.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
So.
Keep predicting which movies, books are becoming movies. This seems to work pretty well.
Yep.
Is he in your voters packet?
Yes, actually, I think that episode was in the voters packet. So.
I'm not sure how that makes me feel.
So that probably helped with the numbers as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Right. So when did the book come out? 2020?
2021.
2021. Okay. Sweet. I think I heard Andy Weir talking about it, and he said something about the state of the art of the science was as of 2019. That's when he started the book. So.
Right.
It's been kind of cool because we've just seen the movie, and so there's a ton of press going on, and Andy and Ryan Gosling and Drew Goddard and Lord Miller and Sandra Hüller are like all over the place. They've been on probably literally dozens of shows and podcasts.
Mm-hmm. Lots of stuff breaking down the science and that kind of stuff. I might bring in a couple of things that I've seen on those.
Oh, also Adam Savage got a set tour.
Oh, sweet.
Which was very fun to see.
Yeah, yeah.
And learn how like they built the set, how like the requirements they needed to build the set, how they were able to get it done, and like seeing the set through different lenses, and you get to see just what the movie is really cool.
Mm-hmm. James, how many times have you read this book?
Just the once.
Okay, so somebody did it.
Yep.
You did not reread for the podcast.
I did not reread for this podcast.
Okay. Colin,
how many times have I read it?
Uh-huh.
Let me think. It came out in 2021. Probably 5 or 6, and I've just started listening to the audiobook by Ray Porter, and he does an excellent job.
Yes. Yeah. Peter?
I have read this book 5 or 6 times.
Okay.
That I can remember.
Okay. I have read it a solid 3, so I read it once. Well, I listened to the audiobook when it first came out just because...
Audiobook,
yeah,
right.
And I had too much other reading to do. And then for the podcast with Peter, I did sort of half and half audio and print, and so this time I was like, okay, I'm going to read the whole thing in print.
I still have not listened to the audiobook.
Mm, it's good stuff.
I know a guy that can maybe loan it to you on a device.
I will ask him later.
Sweet.
Well, maybe the slacker tracks, I suppose.
Yeah. So, we are going to talk about the book, even though James hasn't reread it recently. Peter
and I...
It was
written by a guy named Andy Weir.
Yes, yeah.
Andy Weir.
Yes.
Sure. I know him from his other best-selling book, Artemis.
Andy Weir?
Third base.
Yes.
No,
I've read Artemis, too.
I haven't, so. Okay, so yeah, Peter and I already have our long-form thoughts on it on another podcast, but we can, I'm sure we'll repeat ourselves a little bit.
Rehash those here.
I think
purely original thoughts.
Let's quickly kind of talk about the book and then move over to talking about the movie, and that will drive more sort of back and forth.
Okay, since you guys just did this podcast, do you want to give us a quick plot summary?
Oh, we didn't just do this podcast. It was 3 years ago.
Was it 3 years? It was like 2 or 3 years ago.
2 years ago. I don't think we need to do a plot summary. I think anybody listening to this knows what the plot is.
Yeah. Dude wakes up on spaceship, not knowing who he is or why he's there. End of summary.
Yes.
That's a very short summary.
Everything else is spoilers.
Yeah.
I did have that written down. I had like 3 things written down and that was one of them.
Well, either that or the fact that he's on a spaceship is also a spoiler because he wakes up. He doesn't know that. At least in the book.
At least in the book. Right.
True.
You know, it's the book. I'll just launch in with my thoughts about the book. I think it's a lot of fun. I've read it 3 times. I don't think I would reread The Martian. Maybe in another 10 years or so, I'll be ready to revisit that one. I'll be ready to do all the homework for that. This one, I said on the podcast with Peter, I felt like it was a little more. I don't know if he gave more thought to making it a little more accessible. So there is math underpinning everything, but he doesn't show you all the work. He'll just say, I wrote a script to do this rather than.
Or I wrote some calculations on my arm and it came and it said 1.5 Gs.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
I wonder if that's also just the nature of the characters involved.
Mm-hmm.
Because in The Martian, Mark talks about how he's doing this diary so that when people find the Hab, they will have a log of what he was doing and why he did it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's really a reason why Ryland is writing stuff down. Because it's mostly just his internal thoughts.
Yeah.
There's no set diary for soul whatever or
talent. Yeah, it's. I mean, the book is interior monologue for the most part until somebody else shows up.
Yes.
Right. He's trying to remember who he is and why he's there.
Mm-hmm.
Blah, blah, blah.
Well, one thing that I think is fun that's different than The Martian is that Ryland Grace is a middle school teacher, and so he's used to censoring himself. And so so he says, gosh darn it, you know?
Yes.
it's a little more golly gee, a little more innocent in that way, where Mark Watney made very free with the swears, yes. Which he was stranded alone on Mars. So I don't know. You know, you guys, yeah, well, Colin, you talk about the book since you've reread it recently.
Are we going spoilery? Or I mean,
I think we go full spoilers.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, if you've read Andy Weir and you like what he writes, this is going to look really, really familiar. There is a really intelligent guy that is stuck in difficult situations that are really important. A lot of people call this like a hope fic, because the idea isn't for
hope punk.
Maybe hope punk.
Yeah.
Why hope punk? Why not hope fic?
It is like steampunk.
Nah, I like hope fic better.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, the idea behind The Martian is Mark, we want Mark to stay alive. Mm-hmm. The idea behind Project Hail Mary is that the human race has thrown a Hail Mary to a neighboring planet in another solar system in an effort to save human civilization back on Earth.
Right.
And so there's a lot of importance that comes around with that.
Mm-hmm.
Although based on the amount of humor, you may not see that or feel that all throughout the book.
Yeah, and I would say that I feel like Project Hail Mary is funnier in general than The Martian. The Martian definitely has its humor points in it.
Yes.
Right. We're talking about space piracy and that kind of thing. Yeah.
Right. Although, you know, I think for humor to work well, I mean, there's only so many one-liners a person can deliver.
Yes.
It's like, if whales are mammals, how come Aquaman can talk to them?
Right.
That's
right.
Funny. But like I said, there's only so much you can do with that. He has someone to act against and have a relationship with. And so it's a very different story in some ways.
Mm-hmm. It's like a buddy cop drama almost.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a buddy right. movie book, yeah. Right?
Yeah. It's just, you know, it wasn't bring a buddy.
Right.
It was find a buddy.
Yes. Yep.
Make a buddy, I guess.
Yep. Find a buddy who's already been there for 40 years.
Yes. Right.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Now, if you have come over from listening to Project Hail Mary, did you count how many times Peter said erudite, erudite, instead of Eridian? Because it was a lot. It was funny. I just re-listened to it this morning.
Oh, that explains it. I haven't re-listened to it at all.
Yeah.
Rocky is quite erudite. I'll give him that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The erudite Eridian?
Right.
Yes.
Say that.
James, did you like the book?
Yeah. I remember liking the book. Yeah. It was same style, I think, as other works that I've read from Andy Weir, namely Artemis and The Martian.
That's pretty much
I guess that's it, right?
That's really good, because other than his only two other works.
Okay.
Yeah, he's got some other short fiction.
That's true.
Yeah. But I mean, it's the same style, same like humor, et cetera.
Yeah.
I guess to your guys' point, though, this one does seem a little bit more refined than I think The Martian and Artemis.
Well, yeah, I think it's fair to say he's grown as a writer since The Martian,
exactly.
Just because right?
Well, and instead of, you know, taking time away from a day job or doing this in addition to a day job, it is his job. He can dedicate all of his time and resources to it in order to do it.
Yeah.
And I think there's a level of polish and involvement that comes with that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and now with Project Hail Mary doing pretty well at the box office,
right?
He definitely gets to keep doing it. That was one of the interesting things on your discussion with Robert J. Sawyer on your other podcast about being Canadian, and that was one thing that freed him up to be a writer, because he didn't have to worry about healthcare.
Yeah.
So.
Oh yeah.
We're just plugging all the other side projects here, aren't we?
Absolutely, we are.
Yeah. James, you have anything you want to talk about?
Nope.
All right. So one of the things that have come out of this is because his two adaptations have been so successful. Lord and Miller are interested in doing Artemis.
Yeah.
The big question is, how do you do a movie that is completely set on the moon in less than 1G? It's a really big challenge, because they want it to be, they seem to have a big commitment to, you know, accuracy and believability. Mm-hmm. And I like that.
Yeah.
I hope it'll go well.
I mean, like, you know, The Martian kind of yada yada is the difference in gravity between Earth and Mars, right? It's not as extreme as between the Earth and the moon.
Right.
Right.
But they didn't even talk about it, right? There was no talk of, well, in Martian gravity, this.
As opposed to this book, where there is a whole lot of talk about gravity.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was also left out of the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They don't have time for that. Yeah.
So what else do we want to say about the book?
I don't know, James enjoyed it. You read it in print, right?
I read it in print.
Didn't do a audio listen on one of your big things to come.
I borrowed Colin's copy.
Oh, okay. Nice.
If I remember right. It was easy to read, good book. Same style as the other books. So if you like Martian and Artemis, you'll like Project Hail Mary.
Mm-hmm. And Colin, you've read it 5 or 6 times now, so obviously it's one that that works for you.
You know, I like that combination of a really smart guy using science to figure out things in situations that are really important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Project Hail Mary also has something else for me that is really, really meaningful. So I mentioned this in our episode on Science Fiction 101 when we talked about this, when we talked about Project Hail Mary. I had played tuba almost nonstop since 1999, maybe 2000 when I got a tuba. So I played music in middle school and grade school and middle school and high school and college, did a lot of traveling because of all that, met my wife because of that. We got married. I didn't own a tuba because they're really expensive. And my wife bought me one. And so I was able to start playing again. That all came to an end in the beginning of the pandemic because we found out that wind instrumentalists were super spreaders.
Right. Blowing respiratory particles all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. Sure. And so I hadn't played music in a couple of years when this book came out. And Rocky speaks in music.
Right.
And so on the printed page, there are a bunch of music notes. And they're just the notes. They don't, they don't indicate tone or tempo or anything. But it was music. And so I got my music back in a way.
Yeah, that's cool.
And the Ray Porter adaptation audiobook is even better because instead of showing the notes, they play the notes. And eventually they superimpose the notes with synthesized Rocky voice because they're kind of cutting out the middleman.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just fine. That works. But
For me, the thing that works so well in the book, and I find the beginning of it just a little frustrating, just because it's kind of like I'm thinking of another book, the Doomsday Book, Connie Willis.
Mm.
She has a character fall sick and be sort of delirious for a while, and it's a little frustrating waiting for the character to come out of that, because all of her impressions of things are vague. So with Ryland Grace trying to come out of his coma, I found it a little annoying this time when he's still groggy and stuff, but he says whatever what's 2 + 2 and he says whatever it is, 2 pi i, whatever.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, I'm like, I don't buy it.
I think the math works out.
I'm sure the math works out.
But if you're waking up from a coma, that's not your first or second or third thought.
Yeah. I don't think snark engages that early.
Au contraire.
Maybe not. Yeah. Talk to James before coffee.
5 large numbers of 2. That would have been my answer.
Right. Yes. Yeah, no, that's cool about the music, Colin. You hadn't told me that before. I probably heard it on your other podcast, but yeah.
Yeah, it's cool.
And it was the book that I put at the top of my ballot for the Hugos that year, but it didn't win. But
it was a finalist, though.
It was, yep.
Yeah. I mean, we should probably say it's a multi-award-winning book.
Mm-hmm.
It won the Dragon Award. It won the Goodreads Choice Award for 2021 when it was released. It was a Hugo finalist for 2022. It won the Cyun Award, which I think is adapted fiction in China.
Mm.
And the audiobook won an Audi Award for Audiobook of the Year.
Cool. So yeah, why don't we switch over to, actually, let's talk about this. Like what, you know, Peter and I talked about it a little bit on our other podcast, you know, kind of what our hopes were for the movie and what we expected, you know, how they might change, you know, obviously they were going to have to drop some stuff. They were going to have to, you know, Peter was like, maybe get rid of all the flashbacks. I'm like, I'm not sure that works.
Yeah, I had some wild ideas about how I thought they were going to adapt this at first, which I think the takeaway for the movie for me is I just really need to stop doubting Drew Goddard writing scripts.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, like, and I think I asked you and Tim when we were playing Frolf this week, you know, like, what did you feel like was the most important thing that you wanted the movie to get right for you? And it's an intensely personal thing. It's not like there is no objective capital R right in this case.
Yeah. When you're going from a book that size to a movie, even though this movie is 2.5 hours long, it has to be way, way, way pared down.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that it has, you know, the trademark, you know, Andy Weir science in it. And
Weir science.
Yeah. For me, the big takeaway is, because I love Redemption Story, I need to see Ryland Grace being presented with the choice at the end of the movie and making the right choice, just like he does in the book.
Okay.
For the same kinds of reasons.
Right, because of the arc that they gave him mm-hmm. with showing that, oh, actually, right. no, I'm not brave.
Yeah.
yeah.
He puts the knot in astronaut. Yes. So, James, was there a part of the book that you absolutely wanted to see in the movie? That
Rocky.
You wanted to see Rocky?
I definitely wanted to see Rocky. I wanted yeah. to see how they did Rocky.
Yeah.
Yes. yeah.
Peter and I talked about the idea of being stranded alone in space and then encountering an alien and he looks like a spider. So I'm curious. Yes. I'm curious from you. And he said, burn it with fire.
Yeah. But he's only a five-legged spider, so he's wounded.
Right. Yes. So I wanted to ask, like, kind of first impressions of the movie. And I do want to ask what your more important things were, but did you feel Rocky was too spider-like?
I think he was the perfect amount of Rocky.
I think so, too.
He was... So, from the description of the book, it's basically a Rocky crab. It's yes. kind of how he's described in the book. So, that's kind of what I was imagining more in the movie. So, this more...
Hermit crab. Yeah.
That kind of very, like, smooth crustacean-like shell that might look rocky.
Right.
I didn't think walking pile of rocks.
Right. Greg Knack.
The yes. thing.
right.
Yes. This was not a spider-related thing for me at all. This was a very distinct thing, which I'm very grateful for.
Yeah.
Right. More rock than arachno.
Yes.
An arachnid.
Mm-hmm. Arachnid.
Arachnid.
nice. Yeah.
Took us a while, but we got it. yeah.
For me, the thing that I was really hoping for was just kind of getting Rylan and Rocky correct. Right. Well, not correct, but just like having that be the heart of the movie. Because I felt like in the book, like the relationship is very sweet. The way, you know, mm-hmm. Grace comes to be like, it's weird not having anybody watch me sleep, you know?
Yeah.
And like, because he's internalized some of the culture of his buddy, right? And so, yeah, I really love the buddy comedy kind of aspect of the book. And that's what I was kind of looking for. What about you, Peter? Was there anything you were hoping for specifically?
I think the big thing I wanted to see was that reveal of why/how Rylan ended on the ship.
Okay.
That, I think, is... I think that is the big reveal of the story, not Rocky, which I'll get into in the movie.
I agree.
But that is Rylan's arc, and it's the point of why he chooses to go save Rocky. It makes that even better.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was just I wanted to see them do that right.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I'm not sure I was satisfied with how it was done in the movie.
You can enjoy a movie, you can love a movie and not be completely satisfied yes. with all of it, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, okay, let's then start with what we thought of the movie. So, yeah. So do you want to go first, Peter?
I absolutely love this movie.
Okay.
I've spent a lot of time on social media. It's really fun. As someone who's read the book when it first came out, it's really fun seeing other people see this story for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Granted, it is different from the book to the movie,
yeah.
but people still get in those little moments and then discovering the book because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like I watched a video of a person like tearing up over the whole Rocky's been here for 40 years. Like that whole reveal.
Yeah. Yeah.
That whole thought of this person's been there for longer than we've been alive.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Well, most of us.
one of four of us.
right.
Mascots included.
Okay, mascots
Fair
included.
Enough. Yeah.
Even so, it's a dead heat. And if you count dog ears, then you, yeah.
So I just had to throw one out there.
Yeah, yeah. Colin?
What did I think of the movie?
Mm-hmm.
Boy, I'm torn. And I'm still trying to sit and figure this out because mm-hmm. it's a highly canonical movie. They've made some changes. I don't understand the nature of the changes or why they would make some of the changes they made. A lot of the changes, I definitely understand. There's just not enough time to put everything in there.
Right.
And I'm guessing that audience feedback from The Martian was fairly negative about the science content and the math. And so, and we've talked about this on the disc golf course.
Mm-hmm.
Because I kept using the phrase, it was dumbed down.
Right.
And it was not dumbed down, but it was glossed over.
It was largely omitted.
Yeah. I mean, you would see equations being written down on whiteboards instead of on somebody's hands and arms.
Yeah.
And the results of the equations are handled and dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't there in the detail. And that detail is one of the things I really enjoy.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and that's that, like Peter said, I think that's one of the things that people who go from the movie to the book are really going to enjoy because all those threads are pulled on, right. You know, they might be a little impatient at the beginning with, man, why doesn't this guy just look out a window like he did in the movie? Like, cause he can't get out of the main room until he knows his name.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And I guess that's part of the difference about the ship and the, And I don't know why the ship sticks. I think it's because they took the time to put a diagram in the book.
Yeah.
And that ship and the design, it works really, really well. And mm-hmm. I can bet you that Andy Weir has 10 different spreadsheets and programs that simulate all the things that he's going to be talking about, sure. because that's the detail he goes into. Mm-hmm. And then they change it in the movie. Mm-hmm. And so I was a little flabbergasted. And that was actually a spoiler that came out from a Lego set, of all places, yeah. before the movie was released.
Oh, funny.
And so I found a place where they talked about why they made that change. And so one of the challenges they have is they have with all the condensing of the plot is, how do we show that he's disoriented? Mm. Well, one of the way you disorient people is you change the space that they're in. Mm. And so the room sure. that he's in is designed to have gravity in two different directions.
Right.
Whereas in the book, it's only one. It's very simple. It's very elegant. It works really well. Mm-hmm. But if you want to like throw the audience off, then you do this thing. And so they designed it so that the spin is different, so that when it's under thrust, gravity's in one direction. And when it's rotating for, you know, laboratory and other work mode, gravity's in another.
Yeah.
And the entire space works in both dimensions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just like wonder when you have to wonder why.
Oh, it's I have a second reason.
The art design is really cool. Yeah. Yeah. That's what I was going to say. The art design looks really awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't get what the solar panels are for.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's not like they need aerodynamic stability or anything.
Right. Solar sails. That's what they are.
Right.
Well, they do talk about
getting. Like I said, that's used to power the Mr. Fusion and the flux capacitor.
It's to jumpstart the spin drive. And
yeah. Yeah.
I was wondering about the solar panels too when they first showed the exterior shots of the ship. I'm like, what are those for?
Yeah. I wonder if they're there just for like familiarity because people expect
maybe.
Them. Yeah. On a space station or something else?
I guess.
I don't know.
Hmm. Maybe they were there because, you know, they built it in orbit, right? They had to build it and then orbit it and put it together.
Right.
And maybe sure. they were there for power before they loaded on the astrophage. But
I think they did. Mm. In the movie, I think they really glossed over the astrophase as just standard energy.
Yeah.
So they could just be, hey, stuff on the ship's powered by solar power. Going back to what Strauss
said. But the engine is by astrophase, yeah. right?
As someone who was involved in power propulsion on a ship, they're usually connected in the same way.
Okay. So that's the thing. This brings me to a gripe from Star Wars Episode 3. Revenge of the Sith, right? Okay. It's at some point in that opening battle, right? They're coming down, trying to land the big ship, and it breaks in half. The entire drive section is gone, and somehow they still have power. Right. I'm like, nope.
Nope.
True, no. That's not how anything works.
Batteries.
Yeah, right.
Propulsion line goes away.
Residual electricity.
Midichlorians. So.
I guess what it comes down to is... it's an enjoyable movie. Mm-hmm. I laughed outside several times. Mm-hmm. I really liked a bunch of it, but there are things that I have not quite worked out yet that I don't like.
Yeah.
And I don't understand what they are.
Okay. Well, you'll have to let us know on subsequent viewings if you make peace with it.
Yeah.
What about you, James?
Well, obviously I liked the movie, but, one thing I'd liked about that hasn't been mentioned yet was the cinematography.
The
astro-cinematography.
That was amazing.
Yeah. I thought it was beautiful and the colors were gorgeous.
Yeah.
All those effects, especially when they're like gliding through the atmosphere of Tau Ceti.
Yeah.
Everything about the shots and the cinematography was just fantastic. I wouldn't be surprised if they don't win some awards in that.
Oh, I'd be surprised.
I'd be surprised if they don't.
Yeah, exactly.
They knew when to use CGI and use it well. Mm-hmm. And then all the other practical effects, like they built the entire inside of the ship.
Rocky was practical.
Yeah, the way they did Rocky was great. I love the way that they did the music for Rocky and showing how they.
Yeah,
how he ends up translating it.
Yeah, yeah. What's your girlfriend's name again, or your mate's name? And he's like, yeah. Okay, I got it.
Yep.
Because it was very long.
Yeah. The only time it looked really CGI-y was just the Xenonite suit when Rylan goes onto Rocky's ship, and then Rocky's at the very end in the epilogue.
Mm, yeah.
That's the only time I felt like that's a bit.
Sure.
Like that could have rendered another couple hours.
I thought it looked fine, but because you know it's essentially like you're wearing around a greenhouse. Yeah, right. That's kind of what it looked like.
Kind of reminded me of like the original power.
Oh, the armor in the original Dune.
Yes, what it reminded me of.
Yeah.
That weird like boxy kind of.
Yep.
Yeah, that 100%. Was very terribly CGI.
Yeah.
But that's the only moment.
This was much better.
That was the only moment that took me out of it a little bit. But cinematography is gorgeous. Mm-hmm. You and I were, Dad and I were talking about the cinematography compared to The Martian. And we it's a very different setup from The Martian, because you have Hab, and then you have like your planet shots, you have occasional spaceship. Here it's almost entirely just space.
Well,
no, it's a lot more space too, right?
Yeah.
So The Martian, you're pretty much on Earth or Mars, and Mars being the Hab.
Yeah.
But
or the exterior shots on, you know, the desert shots, right?
Yeah,
but it's still Mars.
Yes.
But it's different than having like space with spaceship.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of these like panning shots, tilting shots, like moving around the ships together. Kind of like a...
You get a lot more of the stars. There was a lot more nebula shots. So just, you know, things that... I wonder how much of it has been influenced by the new web telescope. Because we've gotten a lot We've gotten a lot more detailed shots with that telescope than we ever had with Hubble.
Yeah, nebulae.
The thing that kind of reminded me of, though, of like the...
Some of them looked similar.
Yeah, the exterior spots of the spaceship, the weird thing it reminded me of was like airline commercials, which is a weird thing. Like, you have like person in plane, and then like the ending shot of the commercial is always like plane flying off into distance.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what it reminded me of.
Funny.
That's funny. But yeah, sets are gorgeous. Cinematography is amazing. Costuming is really good. The score is phenomenal. I was listening to it at work a couple days ago. It's very good.
Yeah, I really enjoyed all the aspects of like the filmmaking of it. I thought were terrific. And the performances are good. I mean, it's mainly the Rocky performance, which I can't remember the name.
Ortiz.
Whoever the voice actor is, I think did a good job.
Yeah. James Ortiz.
And then Ryan Gosling and Sandra Hüller. Right.
Yes.
Are kind of the big three. And there's a bunch of the AT&T girls in there, Milana Vantrop.
Yes.
But it's kind of a bit part, right? Everybody else is kind of minor characters. Marcus from The Bear. Playing security guard Carl.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
I think that was a great ad because one of the things that Ryan Gosling has talked about in interviews and stuff is he spent close to 100 days alone.
Yeah.
On a soundstage, doing various kinds of things, right? And so when they were ready to bring in Rocky, he was really ready to bring in Rocky. And I wonder if that was able to influence his performance, because he had that feeling of loneliness and isolation. And then he had someone to act with and act against, even though they were totally alien, because it was a puppet.
Right.
Yeah. So, and the other interesting thing was from Lord Miller, in that one of the things they're doing on theater now is a lot of the actors have in-ears, in-ear mics. And he did that with Ryan Gosling and Sandra Hüller. And because they would do a take and then do another take, and then in the middle of a take, they would whisper a direction to one or the other that the first person wasn't expecting. And it allowed for surprise and spontaneity and creativity.
Yeah.
And I think it really... Well, I don't know what the unreleased versions look like, but...
Because I know they did quite a bit of riffing on things as well.
Yeah.
You know, how's this work? How's that work?
Yeah. Like, you remember the scene where Strutt shows up and starts to talk with Grace as he's trying to get on his bicycle?
Mm-hmm.
So on the first take of that scene, before they start filming, she leans over and goes, "I'll race you to the bike." And that is why that is such a hurried walk across the thing.
Although, awesome.
Yeah, but you know, what we take from that is, I don't want to talk to you. I don't know who you are.
Stranger danger.
With kids
danger.
All day long. I want to go home.
Yeah.
And oh man, it works so well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm really impressed by the directing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one of the things that I saw on, I'll post a couple links to, there's an astrophysicist who on her YouTube channel, she talked to everybody.
The earwig for the maths.
Yeah. And she talked to Lord Miller and asking about, like, you know, how much science dialogue did you have to write? You know, did Drew Goddard have to write, you know? And he said, we had quite a bit of science dialogue and we hoped we wouldn't have to use it because we wanted to tell the story visually.
Yeah.
And so, there's things on whiteboards and on screens and that kind of stuff, but they really wanted to, you know, it's cinema, right? You want to show, you want to show, not tell.
Yeah.
Mm. And that's a hard line to walk. And, you know, it can be unsatisfying for people who want to see the homework, right?
Yeah.
That's what the book is for. Like, Dad and I were arguing about this a whole bunch, about the science, cutting out some of the science parts.
Yeah.
I said I like the opening of him freaking out than finding a window a lot better than, like, the two chapters we get of him before he realizes he's in space.
Mm-hmm.
I think for a movie that makes, it's just a faster way to go about doing that. Some of the other science we just get in passing, when he's explaining the Petrova line to his class, that's a pretty quick... here's my suspended solar model. I'm going to take red tape and just draw the arc.
Oh, yeah.
Instead of talking about the spin drive and how powerful it is, we just get the demonstration of them melting a metric ton of steel.
Yeah.
I love that way of show, don't tell.
Yeah, yeah. I think that was, I do think that was a really good way to kind of shortcut some of that stuff. And, you know, we've talked about, like, how do you adapt things, right? And I think, you know, Phil would tell you too, right? You're going to choose the part that you really want to focus on, and then you need to figure out how to gracefully get to that part. And so, you know, yeah, they shortcut a whole bunch of stuff. I was sitting there thinking, oh, was that when the catheter ripped out? Like right at the beginning.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, like he doesn't have to pass any tests before he can leave the room. And that's very different than the book. But then, you know, he sees outside and goes, oh, okay, where am I? Like Neptune, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah, that part of it kind of comes back a little faster to him. The other thing that they did, they made him a little less competent, right? He was not the jack of all trades like he was in the book, where he had done all the tank work. He had done all the suiting up work in the book.
Right. They're able to play a little bit on the fact that, you know, he's trying to get into the suit.
Yeah.
Although it's a completely different suit. Mm-hmm. It's a two-piece NASA suit versus the Orbon suit.
Right.
Orlon.
Yeah.
Orbon's the Tongri dude.
Oh, yeesh.
Sorry.
Oh gosh. Give me the line from the Men in Black. He walked around wearing a
Egger suit. Yep. Wearing a brand new Egger suit. Yeah, and so that made him a little more bumbling, right? And so, like, the first time Rocky throws something to him, like, he's nowhere near catching it, right? He has no idea what's going on. You know, is that a bomb? Is this a threat? And I also enjoyed just the, like, he's not super adept at moving the ship either. He kind of figures it out as he goes along.
Yeah.
And Ethan really liked the kind of jerky motion of the spin drive, you know, just slightly moving the ship and then Rocky mirroring his move, right? And that kind of pretty quickly gets him to go, okay, well, I guess we're together on this. And yeah, so it just kind of fast forwards a whole bunch of stuff in the book. And like, you know, you always mention the 110, 120 pages, right? This is a 500 page book.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you're getting 20%. Andy Weir in his interview said, you're going to get 5% of the book. Yeah. And so that's where he said, where I sent you the thing after you had said dumbed down the science. I'm like, Andy Weir says they didn't dumb it down. They just yada yada did a little bit.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And omitted a fuck ton.
Yes. That's for sure. Good place. I'm going to bleep that.
Fuck ton. And no one will be the wiser.
Yep. Yeah.
Lots of exposition was cut out.
Oh, yeah. Big time. Well, yeah, and that's where you go from.
I was wondering how much of that they were going to end up doing.
Yeah.
Along with how they were going to end the whole thing.
You go from interior monologue. Right. To okay, are we doing voiceover? Is he doing video messages? And right at the beginning, right? Would you like to record a video?
Yes.
I love that. Yeah, no, that's cool. Screw that. And so they're like, this isn't going to be like The Martian. He's not going to be talking to the camera all the time. Yeah. And so then when he actually does it, it makes it a little more impactful and comedic.
Yeah.
And then once he has Rocky there, then he has somebody to bounce ideas off of. And, you know, the language acquisition stuff, which the book doesn't really tell you how long that took, but it would take a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually it does.
It takes a course of a couple
days. Yeah, I guess it does.
Yeah, they built a language of several thousand words over a couple of days. Mm-hmm. Oh, and there was something that Tim had mentioned in passing about whether or not Ryland Grace had perfect pitch.
Right.
And it mentions, Ryland mentions that he does not have an ear for music, but after you do spend two entire days listening to it, you do develop, you know, a recognition for everything. Yeah. So that was interesting too. Yeah. The comedy aspect of this.
Mm-hmm. There's some great little, so you talked about him kind of fumbling around trying to catch the first bottle and then you get him sitting back up again, opens the door and just floats right in.
Right. Yeah. That was a good use of the camera to like not tell you exactly what's happening. And then, oh yeah. And in the book, it talks about that, right? They figured out where my airlock is.
I was thinking about the comedy between Grace and Strahd. It's like, I'm not here to be like the sacrificial. You guys care if I die, don't you?
It'd be very preferential if you did not die. Yes. Like, it'd be better if you did not die.
The consensus is it'd be better if you did not die.
Yeah.
You voted? You had to vote?
So if I had one complaint, like in terms of like a character that I would have liked to have seen more, it would have been Strahd. Because I think Strahd O'Hurler is a marvelous actor. And And, you know, I would have enjoyed seeing a little more of her, but the movie's, you know, just about 3 hours long. And so we got what we got. And maybe there's an extended edition at some point.
I'm really hoping that they filmed the scene where she goes to the state of Washington to take on the Software Coalition.
Right.
Oh, yeah. And the stand says, I can do what I want. Screw you. I was here to nip this in the bud. Bye. Right.
Yeah. And the judge says, you want what army? The United States Army. Yes. It's a good one.
But like at the moment, that doesn't really do anything for the plot. I understand why that was completely my movie.
Well, that showed how awesome she was, though.
I mean, yes.
She was the person that that we needed at that time, but not the one we deserve.
I did like the... I think this is going to be us just going around saying little bits about the movie, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The scene where she first meets Ryland.
I thought you said farts.
Overhead his bike, just slowly noticed more and more SUVs pulling up.
Right.
Yeah. So there's one in the background, second one that pulls forward, then a third one, and I think there's a fourth one that backs into the very end.
Well, don't they end up like hauling him in there with everybody having a leg and an arm?
Basically.
No.
Something else?
I thought they did.
That was at the very end before he gets the jab.
Yeah.
But like when she's first meeting him, she's like, you're coming with me.
Yeah. Yeah. They did soften Strat just a little bit. And I thought it was an interesting choice to make because in the book, she's very like, look, the entire world's at stake. I don't care who I accidentally kill, you know, or whatever, you know, as long as they're not important to the mission, I'm not going to shed any tears over that. And in this one, you can tell she really does care. And there was that interesting conversation on the outside of the, you know, the aircraft carrier, where she intimates that she might be a theist, right? Which I thought was fascinating because I always pictured her as an atheist. Because he said something about, you know, do you believe in God? And she said something about I don't like the alternative or something. I can't remember the exact line. You'd think I would, but I'll watch the movie again and catch it. But then like when she goes in and sings the song, the karaoke, right?
Yeah.
That was a really powerful moment where you're like, okay, this is not a person who's made of steel. And she doesn't finish the song and she evidently got to pick it.
Yeah. Yep. And if actually that happened because Gosling heard her singing in her room.
Yeah. And so, I thought that was a nice thing where like, okay, you know, she wants this to succeed and she is not completely inured to the idea that she's sending people to their deaths. But this is what has to be done. And she may not feel great about it, but she's going to do it.
Yeah. Now you remember from the book where there's a throwaway line where she says, after you leave and everything starts to settle down, they will probably throw me in jail for all the things that I've done. Mm-hmm. Right. Even though she had their explicit permission.
Yeah.
That's actually paid through in the movie. Hmm. At the end of the movie, where she's on board the ship and they're starting to take action, she has a very small tattoo on her neck. Mm. There's a V with a line through it. Mm. And the V means she had life imprisonment and the strike through it meant no parole. Mm. I would have never picked up on that. Mm-hmm. That's such an inside thing, but it was mentioned in one of the interviews. Mm. So to know that she'd either gotten out of prison somehow in those intervening, you know, 35, 40 years.
Somebody came into office and pardoned her.
Yeah, or something happened.
Well, and this is her punishment.
Mm-hmm. And so now she's in charge of the effort to try and get Talmeba up on Venus.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, who else are you going to get, right?
Right.
It's kind of like in the book when they go to the guy in South Africa or wherever it is, where like, well, here's a person who had some radical idea, so let's go talk to him. And like, if you're, who's the right person to lead the effort to get Talmeba up to Venus? Well, we know somebody who's pretty effective. So some of the Rocky moments that I really enjoyed were when he comes in his hamster ball. Yes. And it keeps going through and it's like, messy, messy. Yes. And Grace is like, I wasn't expecting company.
Line straight out of the book. Mm-hmm. I think that is one thing that Drew Goddard is really good of, just including those little throwaway lines that are very much throwaway lines in the respect to the movie, but are still a conscious choice to kind of reflect, like the opening line is, what is 2 + 2?
Yeah.
There's no better way to open that movie, in my opinion.
Yeah.
They got the line about him expecting company.
Mm-hmm. Amaze, amaze, amaze.
Yes. Right. Yeah. Yes. Oh, fist my bump.
Yes. Fist my bump.
Yeah.
Which I reread the book after we watched the movie. That's only mentioned once or twice at the very end.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Talking about some of the effects and stuff, I've seen all these BS things like Project Hail Mary used no green screens. Like, it's because they used black screens for space.
Yeah.
The Superman, the movie, didn't use any green screens. They were blue.
I wondered if when they're trying to go down into the planet to get the sample of Talmeba, if that was a volume. like yeah, the use from yeah, Mandalorian and Grogu, because that would also not be a green screen. Mm-hmm. It gives great depth perception,
yeah,
and you know, fantastic results we've seen in several different.
Yeah, yeah.
And you can right. still CG the background. You can still CG out of that. It just gives it just makes it a little better to
yeah. do
that.
So talking, well, let me finish with what I was saying. The practical effects, the astrophage hunt when they all disappear in the lab was practical. Those really? Were those were little infrared LEDs that they put on like a chicken wire frame. Cool. And I really liked the camera work where it's like, okay, there they are. There's all three. And then it pans around the other side and you see the other one. Yes. And yeah, maybe they should have been grouped up better than that. But
no,
but
he mentioned they were kind of all over the place.
Oh, did he? Okay.
Yeah.
They're antisocial.
Yeah. Yeah. But I thought that was really cool that they did that because they had, you know, like a filter that they could remove to do the, or put on to do the infrared filming, which was really cool. And, you know, it would have been probably simple to do that with CG, but I'm glad the commitment right. to trying to do practical effects was really cool. There's lots of places where there's something that's super high tension in the book that is a no-op in the movie, like the chain, reeling in the chain, right? It's coming in for forever.
Right.
And he has to, you know, they've got one shot at this. And if it comes in too fast and cuts off that last chain, they lose the payload.
Yeah.
And Rocky evidently figured out a different way to stop it automatically when it reeled all the way in.
Well, it's one of those details that, again, you can lose in the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. There's just not time to deal with that. Mm-hmm. Like the whole thing about, you know, how it took forever to go down and how it like shot links like a machine gun. You can just yeah. show a lot of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like you said, James, and kind of when we first started talking about the movie, the scene of them doing the fishing expedition on Adrian was so cool.
Yeah.
I loved the fact that, you know, several times in the book, he mentions the torch of their engines,
yeah.
but it's only in the infrared range. And he never really mentions that whenever he's doing it, when he's looking for Rocky at the end, trying to dead reckoning his way back to where Rocky is. He's looking for a reflection of his engines, right? But he's looking for it in the infrared. And you don't necessarily think about that in the book, but in the movie, I love the fact that every time, except when they're doing their fishing expedition on Adrian, the engine makes no light, no visible light whatsoever. And that's really cool. And then when they're doing that, you know, it starting to burn the atmosphere, right?
Yeah.
Right. And that just looked amazing.
The spin drives looked really cool.
Yeah.
Because I don't think I've ever fully wrapped my head around what that looked like from the description in the book. Like, I kind of got a triangle that spins and does thing. But, like, seeing, like, a large collection of wind chimes kind of in the movie, just these little spinning things.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and although the spinning they show at the end is I think it's they're turning around.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they're doing, which is a great way to show the engine being on without having visible exhaust from it.
Yeah.
You're going to
see
the things start going, like, okay, engine's gone.
Yeah.
They did cut a few, I'm not sure what level of plot it is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure it's hugely important in terms of the overall story, but into the movie, like, we get the scene of the ship getting a leak, which then makes the astrophage see the Adrian, so they leave, which forces the centrifuge. We got that. We didn't get them having to jerry-rig the Beatles in order to steer back to Blip A to get the extra astrophage.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So going back to Strat's character being a little softer in the movie, I think that's a conscious choice to make the choice of her sending Ryland more conscious as a way to try and make it a little more unexpected.
Mm-hmm.
I was not really a fan of how that went in the movie.
Oh,
it felt just like kind of like a one-off.
I didn't mind it at all, just because I really believed her performance when she was saying a quarter of the population is going to die. And that's if Earth population or if the nations decide to cooperate, but they won't.
Right.
And so it's going to be even worse. And so I'm sorry, you don't have a choice. And so, yeah, I really loved that.
I loved how it played out on Earth. I'm not sure I liked how it played out with Ryland's character in space.
He didn't have a lot of time to gaze at his navel on it in the movie, right? He takes a little more time. It seems like it's more of an impact in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also wish we got a little more time with the Taumiba.
Yes. Evolution.
Evolution. It's a passing moment that he kind of mentions.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he even mentions why they need to
evolve it
in the movie.
No, he does. He does.
Okay.
Again, one of the things it's a problem here is, you know, in the book, we get to spend lots of time at many, many stages.
Yeah.
But in the movie, the pace is so accelerated that there's like a mention and a mention and a mention.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in like the nitrogen fixation of Talmeba happens after Rocky is recovered. In the movie, they happen concurrently.
Yes.
Right?
I wish we got more time explaining that in the movie. That's the one... I think that's the one place I wanted more science explanation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a valid gripe. And I remember thinking after the movie, I was like, I'm curious if Ethan will get it, you know, because Ethan hasn't read the book. And he really enjoyed the movie. He did come home and had a couple questions about a couple technical things, but they weren't anything that detracted from his enjoyment of the movie.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I mean, in the end, all that matters is that they found a way to make it work. Ryland was going home. He realizes that everybody's fuel has been contaminated and that Rocky is screwed. And now he has to make a choice because Rocky gave him enough fuel to go home, which they did not expect to happen, was not going to be an easy ride.
Mm-hmm. Right.
No.
But in the end, right, he finally makes the choice himself rather than having the choice thrust upon him by being drugged and taken to the ship.
Yeah, and like I said, you know, one of the things Ethan was asking about was like, what exactly happened with the Talmeba at the end? I said, well, they got out. And he said, no, I got they got out, but how did they get out? And I went, well, this is where we talk about the evolution part, right. which you know, the current regime made them cut out because it's liberal it. Stuff.
Well, we got, we're evolving it just so we can get it faster. I wonder if it would be possible to find a random thought, just me kind of just brainstorming here. I wonder if it would be possible to make it so they could just escape and not deal with evolution at all. They just have to deal with the multiplication.
No, because then you have to have the reason for him to go back for Rocky.
That's true.
Right. And so it's a critical plot point that they didn't spend a whole lot of time on because they spent the bulk of the time on the main mission.
Yeah.
And I think that was the right choice. It just
bacteria do evolve rather quickly.
Yeah. And you can't tell the bacteria what to evolve for. Right. You're like, okay, I'm evolving you to tolerate nitrogen. Right. And like, sure. And nitrogen is dangerous to me. And I'm in a xenonite box. So I can either try to survive through force of willpower, which doesn't work.
Nope.
A certain percentage of them survive, but the other ones are still trying to get away from it.
Right.
And so figuring out a way through the xenonite was a cool sciencey thing to do.
Right.
And I think random. Almost seems like it's a character. And since we spent so much time with the Xenonite, it makes it a very different, like, oh, this betrayed us. It wasn't it's the twist you're not expecting. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's not a character fault. It's just the thing we're working with.
Yeah. Yeah. But yeah. And then it doesn't take a whole lot of time. And I think Tim was like, he wanted to see more time for Ryland to sit with the idea that, okay, I guess I can't make it home if I want to save my friend.
Although he only goes through 4 years of real time to go to Arid or so.
Right.
And they have the ability to breed astrophage like anybody else. And so then if you can make an 8-year trip.
Well, yeah. And this is the thing, right? The movie does not talk about food.
Right.
Which is the critical thing in the book. Really, yeah. Where he at some point is like, I don't have enough food to get home, even if I'm only in the hibernation slurry, the coma slurry stuff. And so they're trying to figure out, is there anything edible on Arid that he can have. And at the end of the book, there's the kind of weird me burger stuff where they can clone his tissue and then grind it up and turn it into a hamburger.
Yummy.
So you are what you eat.
Yes.
Sometimes literally. Yes. You eat what you are. That's kind of like is it Time Go?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, you're always going to end up with some constriction of stuff and, If that was your favorite bit, then, you know, you might not like it.
Yeah.
I did enjoy that, because I don't remember if this ever happened in the book, and Peter, since you just reread it. In the movie, they spin both ships up. And the reason for doing that is so that you can have gravity everywhere.
Yeah.
So you don't have to spend so much on wire work and that kind of stuff. And it's just, like, to me, it's an obvious budgeting thing. But I appreciated that they never really showed anything where anybody is walking in at a point where there shouldn't be gravity.
Right.
And where in a lot of other movies you get, you know, 2010, the movie, right? Everybody's like walking around like they've got gravity. I'm like, how do you have gravity right now?
Oh, they all had slippers with Velcro on them.
No, was that described in the book? Well, yeah, in 2001, you have you do have the Velcro, and then it shows the lady walking up the curved surface, right?
Yep.
I was glad that they were consistent with that, and I totally understood putting them together. What do you think of the design of Rocky's ship?
I'm still trying to picture what it looks like totally in my head, because it looks like a bunch of straws and spindles.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It's just kind of...
It looks very crystalline, I would say.
See, yeah. I was going to say wicker.
Oh,
I think it looks like a wicker ship.
Description.
is his ship controlled like a sailboat with like the different strings?
No idea.
That was my thought, was that instead of having like a physical control, they like plucked strings and that's what made the ship. So like having the ship look like sails and fins that are just tweakable surfaces just kind of made sense to me.
Yeah, because we know from the book, it's never discussed in the movie, that they don't have any understanding of complex electronics, even though they can build really rich
complex machinery.
Yeah, like ones that give them a tactile display. So you can point this at a screen and it will mirror it in a way. Yeah, that was pretty cool.
That was cool.
Yeah. So it can hear the light and translate it into something that you can,
Some discussions that I missed, like the discussion about how... why everyone in the crew died, except for Rocky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I mean, that was really touching and moving. Mm-hmm. I kind of missed that.
Yeah, I mean, it was there, right? That he didn't know why they all died, and you know, you have that moment of revelation from Ryland in the movie, who's like, "Well, you were right where the astrophage would have protected you from stellar radiation or from cosmic rays." Right?
Yeah, they even gloss over it in the book.
A little bit.
It's described.
Ryland realizes, oh, they died because of no radiation shielding. And in the book, it's, we have some things we needed to talk. After a while, Rocky eventually came around to it. He didn't like it at first. That's how it's done in the book.
That was more the relativity part. Where Rocky wasn't sure that he understood it, but he believes me. But in both those cases, right, there is a little bit of, the scene ends and then it says, we had a new conversation and there were more words added. I love the part in the book where it's like, and we added words like, you know, dumbass. And
idiot, stupid.
Yeah. And one word Rocky would not translate for me.
Well, and he used those words because at a point, Ryland had been awake for so long that he was making stupid mistakes. Like, you are being stupid. You need sleep.
That's one of my favorite lines in the book. It's like, you're not normally stupid. Why are you stupid? It's like, well, I'm on drugs and I haven't slept in a while.
That will do it.
You sleep now.
Yes,
you
sleep.
I watch.
You sleep. I watch. I love all the merch that you can find now. There's one that has like a five limbed thing and it says, you sleep, I watch. Oh. The t-shirt. And other ones that are like, you know, Tau Ceti. Now, just like in the cases of all the old planetary romances, like John Carter of Mars and Shadow Over Mars from Lee Brackett and all those things, the pesky scientists come along and tell you, by the way, there's no life on, it's not possible for, ambulatory human-like life to be on Venus, right? Or on Mars or all these other places.
Sure.
So in the intervening years between when Andy Weir started writing the book, and now the scientists have kind of backed off from the idea that there's likely planets around the Tau Ceti system or in the Forte Eridani system. Andy Weir is completely at peace with that kind of thing, where he's like, it's a fiction book.
It's like the stuff that was in the soil for perchlorates, right?
Yeah. Perchlorates, yeah.
Yeah.
But also... you could say that for like basically every science fiction book.
You can. We've talked about this, right? At what point does a book become no longer science fiction because the science has eclipsed it or made it, just fantasy?
Yeah, canals on Mars.
Or the other way around.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Or you know, like Phil talked about the Martian Chronicles, right? All of this stuff is impossible. It's not science fiction. It's fantasy. I'm glad the movie's doing well. And it was, we got to see it a few days early, which was cool. Anything else, Peter?
No, not really. This is a great movie. I've enjoyed the book. The movie is almost this mix of Interstellar and How to Train Your Dragon.
How dare you, Interstellar?
Yeah. There's some
way more entertaining than Interstellar.
Oh, wait. I downloaded the score, or I pre-saved the score because it's by Daniel Pemberton, the same guy who did the score for Spider-Verse.
Right.
I was listening to that at work a couple days ago.
Nice.
It's a very ethereal score.
Nice.
But there's a couple things that I'm kind of just assuming are Pembertonisms. Like towards the beginning of the movie, there's this random musical click or like repeating sound.
Yeah.
And I turned to Tim, I go, $15 says this is by Daniel Pemberton, because that's in a third of the Spider-Verse score. Just this random repeating one effect that I've heard, because I listened to that across the Spider-Verse score almost once a week. Mm-hmm. Just because it's a nice work music.
So I want to ask you, if you paid attention to stuff in the score, did they have a pipe organ?
I have no clue. I haven't looked into the instrumentation at all.
Okay. It sounded like pipe organ to me, but it could have been synthesizer as well.
Right.
Well, while Peter attempts to look up if there was a pipe organ.
I cannot find whether there's a pipe organ. There was a glass harmonica, though.
Mm. Oh. Well, let's move into final thoughts / rank them. So,
sure.
You wanna go, Colin?
I'm going to still say book movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a slur against the movie, though. It's a good adaptation. I will find out what I don't like about it and then, you know, work through those details.
Nice. Well, I totally understand the feeling of going into a movie that you're pretty hyped for and then being like, there's something didn't get me. I was that way with Interstellar and I'm kind of still there. So
yeah.
What about you, James?
I'm with book movie.
Okay.
What?
Even though you haven't read the book recently.
I know, but I think that I remember what I like. What I remember liking about the book that's not in the movie was actually more of the, I enjoyed all the extra exposition stuff we didn't get in the movie.
Yeah.
Like the paving over the Sahara to build a giant solar farm, right? Like all the things that went into dealing with the situation that we didn't have in the movie, I enjoyed reading about in the book just to build out the context.
I did think that was interesting in the book where it talked about how, and at the end of this, Africa will be an absolute powerhouse in the production of Astrophage for commercial application. Yeah. You know, you can have a AA battery that runs your car for several generations.
Yeah.
It's all the ways that, like, all the ways the planet actually changed, because it's one of the things I like about Artemis, too. I was like, Kenya became like a powerhouse for astronomy and astronauts and the space program.
And rocket launches, because they were equatorially based. And
exactly. Yeah. So I enjoy that kind of stuff that comes out of these weird science that we don't get in the movie, you know? So, yeah.
I think I still go book movie as well. I really love the movie. And so maybe on subsequent viewings, it'll, and like I said, like, I'm not sure when's the next time I'll read the book, but I do like all the extra stuff. I thought it was an excellent adaptation. I thought it was a terrific movie. I think it's one of the best space movies in 30 years.
Very, very, very visually appealing.
Yeah. Yeah. And not just that. I think it's an excellent movie set in space.
Well, yeah.
Do you think this is a better adaptation than The Martian is?
Now, do you mean a better movie or a better adaptation?
Do you think that the movie Project Hail Mary is a better adaptation of the book Project Hail Mary than the movie Martian is for the book Martian?
What I'll say is it's a higher degree of difficulty.
Okay.
Because there's more moving parts to it, right? There's not just the Earth side and the Mars side. There still is that. Mm. But because there's more characters and more things to try and get right, and with the puppetry, with Rocky, I love the fact that you know, he doesn't have a face, but he kind of has a face because of the different colored bits of his stone, you know?
Yeah.
He's like the short flat panel.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
kind of his face. And the body language, right? And all the way they worked that out with the puppeteer, I thought it was just fantastic. And so, like, I don't have really anything negative to say about the movie, but I think I still lean book movie just because. So, Peter?
I almost want to put them on equal footing.
I know.
Okay, this reminds me, so going back of adaptation, this kind of reminds me of the Red October adaptation, where I think if you want a 2.5 hour plot overview of the Hunt for Red October, you watch the movie. If you want the full story, you read the book. I think that is exactly the same place here.
Yeah.
I give that. That's accurate. I think that's what's giving me the book movie. Mm-hmm.
And same. Yeah. And I think I kind of agree. Like I do see them as very equal.
It's just like, if you want more, go read the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I cannot find out whether there is a pipe organ in it.
Oh, I forgot about that.
I was doing some research. Give me a minute. Sorry to make your editing work more difficult.
That's okay.
The score is built around three instruments: glass harmonica, which is
glass harmonica.
So it's a set of spinning glass bowls that you play with, like with wet fingers. So like how rubbing, So imagine that, but just turn on its side and it spins on a wheel.
I gotcha.
The other ones like Miss Congeniality. I'm gonna butcher these pronunciations. Crystal bache, an instrument that uses metal rods and glass to produce sound.
Crystal bucket.
Huh. Sure. And the Ondes Martina. I did not spell that. Say that correctly, which is one of the earliest electronic instruments ever invented.
I bet that's what I'm hearing.
Huh.
Maybe. The sound designer is the same guy who did A Quiet Place.
Oh, nice.
Oh, cool.
And here's another interesting thing I learned about. Do you want to know what Lord and Miller's last live action movie attempt was?
Solo.
Wow. And that got reshot.
They got cut from the movie mid-production.
Like the Super Soldier movie?
No, like A Star Wars Story.
Oh, that movie.
Yeah.
Right. I forgot that movie existed.
Yeah.
They shot the Earth scenes in standard widescreen format, and then all the space scenes are done in IMAX format. Mm. I'm really looking forward to see that in IMAX in a few days.
Yeah. Yeah. I need to reach out to my friend David and find out from a vegan perspective, would you use an astrophage battery? Because it's got living creatures in it, right?
Yes. And since I'm listening to the audiobook, I just reread the part where they introduce a spin drive.
Yeah.
And they specifically say that in the third phase of the triangle, mm-hmm. they scrape off the dead astrophage.
Right. Yeah.
So they may not be refillable.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody who's really conscientious about not harming any living things would say, no, I'm down with astrophage. I do love the whole idea of panspermia, right? Like it's not really a theory that I have a lot of respect for, just because I feel like it's what if we kick the football down that way and we don't have to explain the origin of life on Earth because it came from someplace else? Well, now you have to explain where that came from, right?
Yeah. If you're from Tau Ceti.
Yeah, yeah. Well, no, it was a panspermia event that seeded all the planets. That's what essentially Andy Weir has said. Is that it doesn't explain the origin of all life, but it explains the origin of life on these planets. So
the origin of some life.
Yeah, yeah. All right, I think we're wrapped. Yeah, okay.
Oh, one other thing I'm curious about. Uh-huh. Don't lose if you don't want to. Mm-hmm. The end of the book is slightly different. Is because it? There's no mention of the Meeburger.
Yeah.
Instead of being mm-hmm. on, Forty Eridani, he's actually on a space station.
I don't think he is.
Is he? I thought he was in a biodome.
He was on the planet.
He's on a biodome.
I thought he was above the planet because he's not using the cane to get around, and there's a whole lot of other things which are different. They built him a beach with water.
Right.
And they didn't show us the wave machine for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that they kept it foggy because he's a Bay Area guy.
Yes.
But did that strike you as...
I like this little biodome.
I'll pay more attention to that when I watch it on a rewatch.
I mean, the thing is, the movie doesn't say that it's a heavier gravity planet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so they don't have to explain that. I just assumed it was a biodome kind of thing.
Okay.
Because they can clearly make, buckyballs and things because...
Right.
It was a hamster buckyball.
Yes.
Pretty good approximation of the Oregon coast, I will say. That looks really cool.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Okay. Yeah. No, I think we're wrapped. Yep.
And enough.
Yep.
So what is our April plan?
Well, OMSI is having their science fiction film festival. At some point during that festival, they're playing Solaris, and we just got a request actually through email or through the contact form from Joe Smith. So thanks for reaching out, Joe.
Yeah.
Asking us to do Solaris. And I don't think he knew that it was coming to a theater near us, but Joe, either April or May, we'll hit Solaris for you. Cause there's two movies. Only one of the movies is playing at OMSI.
It's the original one. The original one. It would be hard to find.
Yeah. Well, and then he sent us like a Russian TV version.
Yeah. Which I thought was interesting. I'm like, I didn't know that was there.
Yeah. Cool. Mm-hmm. It's not on YouTube we can watch or someplace? Or
I can't remember what he sent us in the email. I have to go back and look at it. But that'll be interesting. I started reading the book yesterday because I have it on Kindle, and I think I have the audiobook as well. And then I don't know, did we have something else planned? I can't remember.
I want to say that April's original plan was Field of Dreams, and May was something else.
Yeah, I don't want to force you guys to do, I had put a skeleton schedule together for the year, and I would love to do a baseball movie, but, I can always grab a buddy from the Discord and say, hey, you want to do an episode with me on Field of Dreams?
In time for opening day would be perfect.
It would be
a quick turnaround, though.
Yeah, it would be a very quick turnaround.
They are screening 12 Monkeys, which I would be interested in seeing that in the theater.
That's adapted as well.
It's adapted from a short film. Novel.
Short film. It's adapted from a short film.
So do you like Solaris for April and 12 Monkeys for May?
I mean, that would be interesting. And there's a television series as well.
You might get like a quarter of a year of podcasts out of that film festival. Awesome.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, we totally could. The Man Who Fell from Earth is there as well.
Walter Tevis.
Walter Tevis. So, there's plenty of adapted stuff. I think Hugo needs to use the bathroom, so we're going to sign off. So thanks, everybody, for listening. And if you want to listen to more discussion of the book, head over to Hugo's There podcast and find our episode from 2 years ago. Just search for Peter Kesky. It's the only episode he's on that podcast. And until next time, may the road rise up to meet you, and may the book always fall open to where you left off. Thumbs down.
Joe.
Amazing.
Time go.
And movie quotes.
Yes. Yeah.
And omitted a funk ton.
Yes. That's four ton. Good place.
Ton. I'm going to bleep that.
Funk ton.
And no one will be the wiser.
Yep. Yeah. Don't eat the microphone. Right in the mouth. Come on.
It's okay. He probably hasn't licked himself recently.
Yeah, but he gives wet willies to other people.
Oh, gross.